Okay, so now that we've gotten to, like, what's the point of work? Why are we going to work? I feel like you, it's getting late on a Friday night. You'd rather be watching a movie than me, so it's story time. So I'm going to talk about my career and things that I've done, and I'm telling you this not just because I am totally self-obsessed, which I am. it's fine. But also because I hope that sometimes stories are the best way to learn lessons. And I have made more mistakes than many people put together. And so I'm going to talk through some of those. So that's what we're going to talk about now. So quick background. I grew up in the Bay Area. Well, I'm going to go all the way back. Everyone thought I was retarded until I was 6 years old. I'm dead serious. So I was kicked out of the Christian school that my parents had put me in because they thought I should be with the special needs kids because I'm wildly dyslexic, so everything's backwards, so math is easy for me. I can't spell my way out of a wet paper bag, and I had allergies, so I couldn't hear, so I didn't learn to speak till I was five, and I had one wandering eye that was doing its own little party. And so I had these big Coke bottle glasses, and in kindergarten, I was bad at everything that they wanted me to be good at. So, and all I said was, what? Because I couldn't hear them. Anyway, so I got kicked out of school. And it's actually interesting because Malcolm Gladwell did a book on dyslexic kids. So I was not alone, where they get to kindergarten, they realize they're literally bad at everything the teacher cares about. But the thing they are good at is figuring out how to work with other people. And so there was this executive at Disney that by the fourth grade, he realized he could negotiate up one grade, and by the seventh grade, he could negotiate up two grades. So as long as he could coordinate his friend Billy to do his homework and get a C, then he could negotiate the teacher to an A, and he didn't have to work at school. Well, actually, those are really important life lessons when you get into business. You're coordinating and negotiating all the time. I'm not going to recommend that. Don't cheat, children. But, yeah, I saw that back row. as a consequence, I ended up being homeschooled, but it also meant that I got my first job when I was 16, and it was a full-time job, because at 16, I realized I was not going to become a Major League Baseball player. I was good, but not that good, and I just wanted to get to work. I wanted to start earning money, and so as soon as I got my driver's license, I went and worked for .com, doing shipping and receiving. And I could pick up big boxes that the other people couldn't pick up because I'd been working out because I played baseball. I had an incredible opportunity to be at a .com in the Bay Area in the 90s, even as a shipping and receiving guy. I was part of a business that was about to go do crazy things, and God was just very gracious and put me there and put me under a Christian man initially who did not care that I did not have a degree. He cared that I worked harder than anybody else, would show up and do amazing things, right? And so I was given opportunities, and I had to take those opportunities by the grace of God. And so started in shipping and receiving when I was 16. By the time I was 17, I was running the shipping and receiving department, mostly because I was the only one who was, like, sober and showed up and did what I said I was going to do, right? And there's a story for you kids. Stay sober and do what you say you're going to do. Hopefully the first one's easy. So I was running the shipping and receiving department, and then our company, it was a computer automated design company. Kind of boring, but we did 3D CAD software. But what was cool is I looked at all the other engineers and everybody in the company. I'm like, there's no way I can catch up on the knowledge, the skills, and ability that they have, so I guess I'll just keep doing shipping and receiving. But then our company, right in the heart of the Bay Area, bought a company from Atlanta called IronCAD, and it was a new computer automated design software. And I'm like, ha, I am now at ground zero with everybody else. Even if they have 20 years of experience, I now have this competitive advantage of I can outwork them because I don't have to play catch up. We're all learning this software at the same time. So I built myself a server and I taught myself IronCAD, and I literally worked as many hours as I could stay awake and figured it out. Then I went to the training manager and said, I can teach this software at the ripe old age of 19. I can teach this software. Why don't you give me an opportunity to go out and teach it? He's like, I don't believe you can teach it. I'm like, give me any problem, I can do it in this software. And I did everything faster than everybody else because I was a young guy and had nothing else to do. And they all had busy jobs. So I went on my first business trip when I was 19 years old. I did not bring my razor, and it didn't matter because I didn't actually shave very much. And it's hard to get a rental car as a 19-year-old, as a side note. So there was all these challenges, and then back to anti-fragile. But I also learned some really important lessons, because when you have to go out and do really hard things like that, and no one's helping you, and you're just kind of on your own, it is a very formative moment. And again, this is back to you parents. Don't overprotect your kids. Put them out in spots where they have to do really hard things. And they might fail. And I did fail. I remember teaching my first class in Chicago, and it was the most boring, horrible class that had ever been taught, and it was a full 8 hours of that. And, like, people wanted to die. They were, like, committing kari-kari or whatever the thing is, seppuku. But one of the other employees, one of the salespeople, came to me and said, okay, Andrew, that was horrible. And he was straight up. He's like, that was the worst thing I've ever seen. But you clearly know your software, so let's talk about how to get more engaging. And he literally sat down with me for hours and walked through the whole thing. By the grace of God, that was one of those moments when you invest in someone and it worked out. Anyway, I got very good at training. I got to go all over the world doing this. And in fact, I started going to, continued to do, and it's, this is what, I was blessed to be part of a fast-growing .com in the Bay Area when people did stuff, right? And they're like, hey, we don't care if you have a degree. You're 20 years old. Why don't you go to Tokyo and build our VAR program, our value-added reseller program? I'm like, really? Sure, let's do this thing. So ended up growing a lot, learning a lot. I also learned what venture capital money does to a business. We were a successful business earning a couple million dollars a year, plugging along, and then the dot-com craze hit the Bay Area. So we took $32 million of venture capital money, and we changed our budget from $2 million of profit a year to $8 million of loss a year. We were trying to grow as fast as possible and spend the money as fast as possible. And getting a front row seat, I wasn't on the executive team, but getting a front row seat to the decisions that are made when you have that kind of steroids hit your business and you now have to grow at almost any cost was incredible. I learned about budgeting. I learned about what happens when you go play, you know, $1,000 rounds of golf in Tokyo, because why not? I turned 21 on an expense account. I remember the first bottle of wine that I ordered at a restaurant. I'm like, I don't know, this one at the bottom. It's only $500. Let's do it. So not recommended, but these are the stories. This is how you build, you know, this is how you get built as a person, and you start to enjoy work. You're like, hey, I can go out and do these things, right? Okay, so fast forward, doing all this stuff, ripe old age of 22, I'm working 80-hour weeks, and I've been doing that for years, and I just got burned out. I was like, I don't have a girlfriend, I don't have a life, what's the matter with me? So moved up to Moscow, Idaho. Now you know the background. That's where why I got to Moscow, and I moved to Moscow because I just wanted a good church. I'd been going to a church in San Francisco, an OPC church, and Chuck McElhinney was a pastor, and he spoke out against homosexuality, and in San Francisco, that's not popular, and so we literally had to fight through a picket line every Sunday morning to get into church, and there were people who were, like, banging drums during the sermon. Like, it was crazy times. He had his house firebombed. Remember the left really is the violent group. So, but there were some weird things in the church, so we moved up to Moscow, decided to go to Doug Wilson's church. It was amazing. But then I got to Moscow and found out, guess what? There aren't any good jobs here. You're either working at Walmart, you're working at the hospital, or you're working at the university. And that was kind of it. And I think the hurts were there right when I got there. And you know, there weren't jobs. So people would come, they'd go to NSA or whatever, and then they'd leave because there really wasn't an opportunity to stay. I'm like, okay, well, God gave me these crazy experiences in the Bay Area. What should I do with them? This is the skills, the knowledge, and ability that I've been given by God. How should I use it to bless other people? Well, if I want a job, I bet other people want a job. So I should make jobs. Ta-da, it's not that hard. The nice part about being stupid is you think, it can't be that hard. I'll just make a business and make a ton of jobs. And sometimes God blesses that. So not knowing what you shouldn't be able to do is actually a huge blessing sometimes. So I got connected with these two economists who had this labor market data company. And just to be honest, like, you always think, like, the first day at a cool startup, even in Moscow, there's these two economists. They have customers. They have product market fit. They've got a lot of things. I'm like, guys, you guys have a real business here. And they're like, oh, that's cool. Do you want to run it? I'm like, sure. And so first day on the job, I'm like, okay, so I'm hooking up my computer under the desk. And we had these little dividers. I don't know if you remember those. If you're old like me, you will. They were these like fabric dividers. Anyway, I bumped my head against it. It fell over. It made this huge boom. One of the economists jumps up and he's like, Andrew, are you dead? And I'm like, no, I'm just under the desk. And so he's trying to put this thing back up. And the other economist was a total hippie and he had ferns hanging all over the office. And so the first economist, Shell is his name, K-J-E-L-L. He's from Norway. Anyway, he's trying to get this fern off. He didn't know that Hank, the other economist, had just watered the darn thing. And it was like on those four wires, and it was hooked to like the drop ceiling. Anyway, so every time he picks it up, the wires flex, doesn't go anywhere. Finally gets it to unhook, but it only unhooks those two sides, and this like mud flood comes down on his. And he grabs this thing, he rips it off, and the ceiling's like, ring! And I'm like, and he throws it in the car, he's like, I'm out of here! And he leaves, and I'm like, this is my first day on the job. It's amazing. It's going to be awesome. So, anyway, so that's how MZ started. And it turned into a bigger, better thing later on. But what we saw was we had an opportunity to be a blessing to this community. I saw we had a product that customers around the country wanted. We had an opportunity to get money from outside of the region to bring it into Moscow. And I had this heart for the labor market. I had the heart for, like, how do we create jobs in this silly little town? We understood doctrine in a lot of ways. There were a lot of academics in Moscow, people reading big, heavy books, but you gotta pay for stuff, right? We need money to do stuff. And you get money by creating jobs, and not just jobs where you're barely paying the bills, but jobs where you have disposable income, where you can go out to dinner, because I love to eat, which you can probably tell from a distance. And I knew that if we had good, high-paying jobs, we would have better restaurants, because then people would earn enough money to go out to dinner. It would afford restaurants, ta-da. So that was really my heart. So when we started MZ, my initial goal was 50 people earning over $50,000 a year. 50 at 50. And I did that, and that is a terrible business goal, as a side note, because you can go bankrupt, and I nearly did, getting to 50 at 50. You can hire a bunch of people, but you have to make money to pay them, turns out. Found that out later. That's where Timothy came in. But we had this goal of 50 at 50. How do we create prosperity in our town by creating jobs that are going to be meaningful for families, right? That was really what we were trying to do. And we were doing it with labor market data, which I know sounds really boring. But it actually is tied into that, because if you have labor market data, which is the ability to know what you should do with your career, what you should do with your education, think about how much decision-making information, decision-ready information is on your phone about where you should go to dinner tonight. Can you go on a vacation? Can you afford a house? Can you get a mortgage? What should your career be? What's the skill that you could add to your basket of competencies that would get you the highest raise at your job right now? There's not really good information on that. Or what professors should I go to? What skills should I get in college that are going to create the highest economic return for me as an individual? There's not good data on all of that. So that was what we were trying to do. Create that data, and in the process, bless the Moscow economy, right? And that's the heart of what business is about. I describe business like this. And we're going to talk about why you should start a business later. But think about business like this. If you want to take a meal to a family in the church, which I think is a really good thing, you know, they have a baby, you bring them meals. That's a great thing. Well, if you wanted to do that for one family, it's cool. If you want to do it for 20 families every night, you're going to go broke and your wife's going to die, right? Both bad outcomes. But how do you do that? Let's say you actually want to take meals to 20 families every single night. Let's say you want to take meals to 1 million families every single night. Well, it's called DoorDash, right? You use the friction of commerce, the friction of business to bless people at scale. That's what business is at the end of the day. It's an opportunity to take a good thing and bring it to scale so that you can bless more people. It's blessing at scale, right? If I wanted one kid who was in a community college to have the information they needed to understand what career they should pursue that matches that Venn diagram of vocation, that'd be great. And I could go and spend a ton of time and energy doing that. But with business, I had the opportunity to build data scientists and user interfaces so I could help 1 million people, right? And that's when you think of business, it's not this evil thing. It's a wonderful thing. It's an opportunity to bless people at scale. That's fundamentally what business is. So that's what we were trying to do at MC. We were trying to bring prosperity to the Moscow economy, and we were trying to bless people with this data at scale. Okay? As we continued this, two of our engineers actually came up with a student information system, now called Populi, within the business, and they came to me and they're like, we're engineers, we don't know how to run the business, do you want to buy the business? I'm like, yeah, sure. So we bought the business, and then we incubated inside of MZ. I don't know if that was the best plan, but we did, and actually I have some more thoughts I want to share in a second on that. But so we incubated this business inside of MZ, which was great, but it also meant that we were barely profitable all the time because we were also incubating this not profitable business inside of MZ. At about this time, the two economists, Hank and Shell, were ready to retire. And I know I just talked about retirement. I'm not going to make any judgments on what they should have done or not, but they wanted to not be part of that business anymore. And so I thought there's two things that kind of went into my initial decision to sell the business. One, they each owned about 33%, and I owned 33% of the business, and they wanted to get out, and I couldn't afford to buy them out. I didn't have the money for that. And I also, not to be prideful, I knew more about business than anybody else I knew in Moscow. There weren't just lots of business people in the community. There were lots of very wise men, very godly men, but not a lot of business people who understood renewal rates and gap revenue and all these other things that are really helpful. So we went through a process and sold the business, ended up selling it to a private equity firm out of Palo Alto, back to my roots. That's about the time that Timothy, I was fortunate enough to bring in someone who knew that there were two A's in GAAP. I didn't know that before, but that was kind of cool. GAAP accounting, anyway, it's an accounting joke. Went over about as well as most accounting jokes do. Sorry. So anyway, we sold to a private equity firm out of Palo Alto, which was actually a great experience. And I'm just going to throw out numbers. They bought it for like $8 million. I also learned that they knew how to structure deals. Because they bought it for about $8 million. They put $4 million of their own dollars in. They let me hold on to a percentage of it, so they didn't pay $8 million because they only bought their, whatever it was, 72% of the business. And then they put debt on the rest of it. And I'm like, why would you put debt on this? You have enough money to just buy the thing. Why wouldn't you just buy the thing? But they're like, nope, this is how we structure the deal. So they put $4 million of their own cash in, call it $2.5 million of debt on the business, and guess who provided the debt? Well, they did, and they provided a 12% interest because they were buying the business, they had a majority, they could just decide, I'm gonna charge 12% interest, and you're gonna pay it. And guess what, the business paid that debt. So I was like, oh, interesting. That's an interesting way to structure this deal. They're basically making it so, and they could go and get that debt for like 6%. They charged us 12% because they had enough assets that they could get cheaper access to debt. And so now they're getting higher interest, they're making money on the interest, and they just have this piece of debt. Well, fast forward 2.5 years, and it was like an MBA. I learned a ton from those guys. They were frustrating at times. We didn't see eye to eye on worldview, all of those things. Fast forward 2.5 years, and we sold the business for $40 million. Okay, so how did that work out? Well, they paid off the debt piece, which was only $2.5 million, and against $8 million, that felt like a lot. Against $40 million, it's a rounding error. Like, it's a small amount of money, and we've been making payments on it from the profits of the business for 2.5 years. Okay, so that debt's gone down, but they still own the majority of the business for only the $4 million that they put in, right? They even let me earn some ownership through performance. They let other people earn ownership through performance. Anyway, they got 6.8 times their money in 2.5 years doing it that structure. Because if they had put in the full $6 million rather than doing the debt component, they would not have had that kind of multiple on their money because they would have had to put in more money and they would have gotten the same ownership. But using that debt component, and it was just, this is when you get into the business world, you're like, ah, that makes sense. But until you actually walk through those scenarios, it's really hard to understand. And this is where I think Christians need to learn from the, you know, children of light or not as wise as the children of darkness. Like, they know how to use money. I've also talked to a lot of business people who are like, man, I can't wait to sell my business. I'm building to sell my business. In retrospect, fast forward, you know, now 20 years, MZ, now Lightcast is probably, I don't know the numbers, so this is not an official declaration, but probably producing $40 to $50 million a year in profit, in cash profit, right? Well, that's pretty cool. Think about if I still owned that, or if I and two economists still own that. We could literally build a cathedral every single year. Like, that's the scale of business, right? And so when people buy it and they're like, wow, they just paid a ton of money for my business. Yeah, well, they're not idiots. They're doing it for a reason, right? And so anyway, so we continue to grow the business. We look for opportunities. How do we bless people at scale? And those private equity guys actually were really helpful. They gave us a lot to push for. The other thing we had to do in business at this moment is we realized, okay, we have pagan bosses on our board. How do we be distinctly Christian in this moment? Because this is one of the huge advantages. If I just owned the business and I hadn't had pagan bosses who were very savvy Bay Area business guys, I would not have had to grapple with, okay, how do I make a culture that is our own? That is a thing that we actually believe in as Christians. And I think so many Christians have abdicated that culture building inside of their business. And I think there is an opportunity to do stuff really important. So there's a couple things that we did, and Timothy was part of this, where we thought, okay, how do we articulate the culture that we're going to build so that we are distinctly Christian, even if we're not owned by a Christian business? So the first thing we said is, what are the three principles that are going to drive all of our decision-making? In business, there's a million different things you can do, and so you can make really bad decisions at scale, which is great, but you want to be able to see through the fog, and the best way to do that is have values and principles that you're using for business. For us, it was, we want to bless our customers. We want every customer to be better off because they interact with us whether they buy anything or not. And this had an impact on customer service. When you're talking to someone, our job is to bless that customer, not just get money from them. We're not seeing them as an invoice number. We're not seeing them as a customer number. They're someone we want to bless. We want them to be better off because they interact with us whether they buy anything or not. Well, it's interesting. When you set out that principle for all of your employees and you talk about it literally every single week, it changes behavior at your organization. And all of a sudden, the point of business is to bless those customers. And oh, by the way, we make a bunch of money, right? But if our first focus is to bless those customers, it totally changes the way you interact with people, changes the way you innovate, it changes the way you think about renewal rates. All these things flow from blessing customers. And it's so funny because blessing is like this dog whistle word, because if you use the word blessing, it's a fine word, but every Christian's like, oh, I know what's going on. That's a word. That's a Christian word, right? I mean, they know it, right? And so this was a thing that we could do. We're like, bless the customer. And then the next one, bless the employee. We want every person at our company to be a better person because they work here, okay? And that had dramatic ramifications. First of all, I would say things like, hey, I want you to be a better employee here, and I want you to be a better employer for your next employer, better employee for your next employer. In fact, I would encourage you, I will be a reference for you if you ever need to go and get another job somewhere else. I'm trying to bless you. I want you to be a better person. Go make a ton of money. Do whatever you want. Turns out that produces an enormously high retention rate. People don't leave when you say, you're welcome to go, right? They don't feel trapped. They feel like, okay, this is a place I want to be. And then I would explain to people, and here are some of the reasons, some of the ways that I want you to think about bless the employee. Because not only is that on me, is that on the board, but it's also on all of you to bless your fellow employees. So we're already blessing our customers. Customers come first, employees come second. It also means that there's going to be behavior that we are going to follow at this business that is blessing to all of you. So first one, we do not stand for gossip in this business. If you have something to say to someone, you say it to their face, and if you don't, you might be fired. So I would tell new employees, if you come to my office and you say, hey, Andrew, you're really screwing up and doing a really bad job as a CEO, I might give you a raise. Because I have blind spots, I need people who have the guts to speak into the CEO's life like that and say, hey, you're missing the boat on this, right? And so you might get a raise. But if you come into my office and say, you know, so-and-so, they're just not cutting it. I think that you maybe should, you know, let them go. I don't know what to do with them. You might get fired if you do that, because that's just gossip. That's going around their back. And often I would have employees who would come in my office and say, you know, I'm really worried about so-and-so. I'd be like, hold on 1 second. Go on, come back. And I'd bring that person in. I'm like, why don't the three of us talk through this right now? Well, tell you what, that's super awkward. I love awkward. It's kind of my superpower. I mean, my last name's Crapuchets, for crying out loud. So I love awkward. And guess what? It doesn't happen anymore when you do that. And often they're just, it's just political maneuvering that was happening. And you nip that sucker in the bud, and guess what? Innovation comes. Because everybody knows no one's going to talk behind my back. I can come up with a stupid idea, and someone's going to tell me directly. They say every good business idea comes from 9 stupid ideas, right? So you got to have a bunch of stupid ideas, and then they triangulate into like, oh, wait, this might work, right? And so innovation comes when you know that people have your back. The other aspect of bless the employee was you realize I, as a CEO, am not just managing people. I'm managing everlasting souls. These are people that we're gonna spend eternity with. Well, that changes the way you think about it, right? I had one employee who lied to a customer, and I had to fire him that day. And I said, we just don't, you know, bless the customer. That's the first one. You lied to a customer. You did it intentionally. You got to go right now. Turns out that very stiff conversation that I had with him was exactly what he needed as a person. Because I found out several months later that his marriage was in really bad shape. And he was just had this pattern of lying. And I was the only person that had this lever in his life that he had to listen to because he just lost his job. And that was the kick in the pants that God used me to give him to fix the things in his life that he needed to fix. And we're actually good friends now, even though I had to fire him. I had another employee who had an anger problem. And it's funny how sin doesn't stay in nice, tidy buckets. If you have an anger problem, it's going to show up at work. And he yelled at someone. I said, so this is a, you know, 2 strikes, you're out. I'm going to give you 1 chance on this, but you need to deal with this all the way down. Go get pastoral help, whatever you need to do. This anger problem will destroy your career, and it is not welcome here. We are a bless the customer, bless the employee business. You need to deal with this anger problem. Same thing. His marriage was actually in not great shape because he wasn't dealing with that anger problem. And multiple pastors had talked to him before. But I had this lever of signing his paycheck. And suddenly he had to listen to me, and he actually dealt with that sin all the way down. Right? Now, I can't deal with sin that has no impact on the work world. Right? I'm the boss. I'm not the pastor. Pastors have a different job. But you do as a boss when you're thinking, I'm going to bless the employee. I'm going to think about this person as an everlasting soul. It changes the way you interact with those people. Right? Does that make sense? And so those are the first two principles. So first we want to bless the customer. Next we want to bless the employee. And there's lots of these ramifications that come from that. And then the last one is we want to bless the shareholder. And people are like, well, shareholders, that, you know, dirty capitalism. No, I am a man under authority. I had a board. I had shareholders. I had people who had invested. And I cannot expect people underneath me to do what I ask them to do or to do what I tell them to do. I mean, there's this one-to-one correlation. I sign your paycheck. You do what I say, right? That's just how the world works, right? But if you want people to really love taking direction, taking authority, you need to realize you need to be under authority. The person who will not take correction, will not take any input from someone above them, is a terrible manager almost all the time. And so that's why we wanted to bless the shareholder. We wanted to say customers are first, employees are second, but shareholders are on the list. Now, there's still number 3. We're not about just making money. And it's funny how God built the world. When you focus on things other than just making money, you make a ton of money. That's just how it works. And so we focused on taking care of our customers, taking care of our employees. Shareholders always did really well, and I always talked about the shareholders because I wanted everyone to know I'm under authority and you're under my authority. That's how it works, and it's okay. Okay? So having those Palo Alto owners forced us to really think through those things, like how are we going to be distinctly Christian in the way that we run this business? And those are the principles we use. And there were lots of ramifications. I won't go into all of them. That we, you know, whenever I had a new employee come in or a new potential employee come in, I would interview them. And I'd say, by the way, I'm an unapologetic conservative Christian CEO. Here are the ramifications of that. It's not a prerequisite. It's not a weird thing. Everyone is welcome. but I don't want you to come in with some, you know, weird conception of what you're coming into. I'm probably going to pray at the company dinner. Just that's what you're coming into. You're totally welcome. I just don't want you to be blindsided by this. Well, that actually was a cool legal protection because it's like the contents of this cup might be hot, you know, the McDonald's thing. And then if you spill it on your lap, they're like, we told you it was hot. And the CEO's hot. Get it? Sorry. Okay, let's keep moving along. So we continued to grow the business. We actually ended up selling it. So 2.5 years in, I'd learned a lot from the private equity guys. They were wonderful, but I kind of had learned what we were going to learn from them. And the private equity play, for those who don't know, private equity buys a business. They invest in the business a lot to grow the top line. They don't care about the margins. And then about 2.5 to 5 years in, depending on their strategy, they then start cutting costs like mad so that the margin just goes crazy. And then they sell the business on a multiple of that margin. Does that make sense? So that's kind of the play. So 2.5 years in, we started to get this weird behavior from them. They're like, yeah, I don't know if we want to pay for that. I don't know if we should hire another developer and actually innovate for the customer. I'm like, hold on. I care about blessing the customer, blessing the employees, and then blessing the shareholders. And they're like, yeah, I don't know if we're on the same page here. I'm like, yeah, probably time to go. So we went out and found another business to buy us. And I'll just, you know, be honest, I spearheaded that. And they weren't looking to sell us. We had a great partner in CareerBuilder, the big job board. And so I just went to CareerBuilder and I said, hey, you should buy us. And they're like, well, how much do you? And I said, I bet they'd take $40 million. And they're like, okay, let's do it. It was a little more complicated than that, but honestly, not that much more complicated than that. So we became part of CareerBuilder. The Palo Alto guys, still good friends, made a ton of money. So now we are part of this huge organization full of pagans. And so we really needed to double down on what are we doing with our culture? How are we thinking about ourselves as distinctly Christian business people? Because if we don't, we're going to lose where we're going. And by the grace of God, we did that. We continued to grow. I actually ended up running a division of CareerBuilder for a while, which was a terrible idea that nearly killed MZ. During this time period, Timothy and I did some other things. We did Element Robot, which is a 3D printing business that we sold off to Stryker. Got away with our shirts on, barely. I think that's, yep. So business doesn't always go amazing. So I'm telling you all these amazing stories. We were with CareerBuilder for 5 years, and then we sold for like $160 million. And then we were with that company until 2020. And that company was actually a nonprofit. It was a weird business. It was great. They had a ton of money. But they were a nonprofit out of Indianapolis, a bunch of Mormons. They were easy to work with until 2020 came around. And then God decided that it was time for me to stop doing the thing that was easy and comfortable. Back to what I told you earlier, whatever's the hard thing, that's probably the best thing for you. And they basically came to me and said, look, we need you to make a statement about George Floyd. We need you to push COVID stuff. And I'm like, yeah, I'm not going to do any of that stuff, so sorry. And then they did a dossier on me and found out I'm a Christian and I go to a church. And then their board basically told me, hey, if you want to keep your job, it's great, but you need to stop being a Christian. If you could just park the Christianity on the weekends, that'd be great. And I'm like, okay, so the whole culture of what we've accomplished here is not that. And you don't understand, you were going to shoot the golden goose in the head, right? Where at that point, we were growing 25% a year with a 40% margin, right? We were just high growth, high margin, large business, just creating tons of free cash flow for these shareholders. But they cared more about worldview, which is a lesson for a lot of us. Because Christians sometimes are like, well, I'm going to, you know, be a smart business person. But they cared more about worldview than cash. We basically had this long disagreement. I won't go into all the details, but basically the net was like, you either fire me for being a Christian, and there's going to be a long line of people who are also walking out the door with me, and you're going to have a smoking crater of a business. Door number two is Timothy and I are the culture committee for the board, and we get to just decide all that stuff, and you leave me alone on that. Or door number three is I go find another person to buy us, because clearly you're not okay with what we've accomplished here. The culture we've built. And so they took door number three. We went through a last process. This would be the fourth time we sold the business. I found a great buyer. Unfortunately, KKR's ESG fund had more money and outbid that buyer. And guess what? I left because they didn't want anything to do with me. And I'll be honest, like that was a moment where like, okay, I built this thing. I've been here for 20 years. People I love, like, Lord, what are you doing here? And then I accidentally started Red Balloon. I'll talk about that a little bit more later, but it was an accident. I started it, and we've now helped thousands of businesses, and we've brought hope and jobs to hundreds of thousands of job seekers. And my wife wrote this article, and it was very sweet of her. She's a lot smarter than I am. She wrote an article for the Federalist saying, my husband wasn't fired, he was redeployed. And when the king tells you to go take a new hill, who are you to say no? It's like, oh man, babe, come on. So there you go. That's what I did. We started Red Balloon, and we have been able to bless a lot of people through that. But I'm telling you these stories of business because I want to inspire you. I'm that retarded kid from the Bay Area, literally, who, by working really hard, by trying to be faithful, by stumbling along, by surrounding himself with really smart people like Timothy, and I could go on a long list of people who have just been incredible people who I've gotten to build businesses with, have been able to build $100 million businesses to the glory of God. And when I drove, and I remember there was one moment I was driving around the Bay Area right when we sold MZ the first time, and I don't remember if it was a Dropbox or one of those businesses, I saw their headquarters, and it's like this big, beautiful building. I'm like, daggone it. Why can the pagans build huge businesses like that and push their worldview with everything they've got, and us Christians don't? We serve the Creator God. Like, He made the universe. We should be the ones doing this. We should be the captains of commerce in a Christian way. And so my encouragement to you is, if a dumb kid from the Bay Area can do it, so can you. And if pagans in the Bay Area can build huge businesses, so can you. Tomorrow's talk, I'm going to talk about why ambition is important as Christians. And so that will tie into that nicely. But my encouragement is, there's my story. I don't know what God's story is for you, but I'm really excited what a bunch of inspired people who are trying to be distinctly Christian in what they're doing are going to do to Lynchburg. Thank you. You can ask me anything. How much I weigh? Anything. Yes. Yeah. Very much so. Yeah, it's a great question. First of all, I married really, really well. First of all, I was born without tear ducts, so I didn't cry about it. But it was I wasn't born without tear ducts, but I cried when Annabelle was born. There you go. But I realized this was, you know, part of God cares more about the players than the score. My identity was tied up in CEO of MZ, not in Christ. And I know that sounds like, oh yeah, well, idiot. But like, it's very easy. Like, your vocation, this is the thing that I poured my heart and soul into. I loved it. And I think, you know, God was using it to remind me that my identity is in Christ. And that's how it was like, oh, okay, I need to go do something else. When I kind of came to that realization, again, through the wise counsel of my wife, a lot of time in prayer. I also realized my prayer life wasn't as good, and when you lose your job, it gets better. So God's blessing me in that way. Bible reading's better. I got more time to read books. I got smarter, all those things. So, but I think that was the fundamental thing, was my identity is not my job. It's not my vocation. It's in Christ. And which means that if God says, go take a new hill, you're redeployed to go do something else. I'm like, yes, sir, I'm on it, because my identity's there, not in the vocation. Does that make sense? But that was a multi-month, like, oh man, I got to grapple with this. So, yes. I like to think I was very strategic, but I don't know if I, we did. I mean, I tried to negotiate to get chunks of ownership, and I wanted, I wanted the ownership because I'm like, I think we can grow a lot more, and I want to learn from these Bay Area guys, for instance, or the Career Builder people. And God really blessed it, right? Because it gave me a lot of cash to be able to go do other things. I own a bunch of commercial real estate. I'm doing a housing development in Moscow. Don't do a housing development. But I am doing one. It's terrible. But commercial real estate's fantastic. I've got buildings all over Moscow. I was telling someone I like to play Monopoly, and I like to play real Monopoly with buildings. But holding on to ownership was actually a huge blessing. Gives you skin in the game, kept me engaged, and I got to, follow the track all the way through. Yeah, I mean, it was something I said I need. If you want to keep me here, I want to not just be a salaried employee. I want to be a person who's owns a chunk of the business. So, yes. Mm-hmm. So if you put in $6 million and you get 70% of the business and it sells for, to keep the math easy, $16 million, which means the value of the business doubles, then you just took your $6 million and it's worth $12 million. Cool. But if you put in $4 million and you get 70% of the business and you use debt for the other piece, and then the business also sells for $16 million, you have just tripled your money rather than doubling your money, because the business is worth more and you still only have, the debt is only the $2 million. It doesn't grow exponentially with the size of the business, right? It's just, it's a fixed number with an interest rate, whereas the ownership grows exponentially with the size of the business. So when they went from $8 million to $40 million, the debt stayed at two, and so their $4 million, which was 70-some-odd percent of the business, is now 70% minus $2 million of a $40 million piece. And so the it was just leveraging their capital better so that they got a higher return on that. Does that make sense? It's tricky. There's spreadsheets. Timothy could explain it. I probably even explained it wrong. Maybe you could. Just so you know, the talk tomorrow morning is going to be fixing all the things I made up on the spot. Yes. Yeah, they were just getting a loan. They actually went, because they had a bunch of assets, they could go get a really low interest loan, and then they made a loan to the business. Anyway, they made it complicated enough that they made a ton of money. But yeah, it was just using debt to leverage into it. And so there was kind of a debt capital thing. Yes. 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 This is in fact what Red Balloon does for a living. Part of the reason I talked about the values for our business is every business should know what they believe and not be afraid to say it. Because and I'll just pick on ours, so bless the customer, bless the employee, bless the shareholder. Well, if you're asking someone, you're not allowed to ask them, hey, do you go to church? Or how old are you, right? Those are protected categories. You're not allowed to ask those questions. But you say, but you do want to ask open-ended, evidence-based questions. The point of an interview question is to gain evidence that they're going to be a good culture fit and a good skill fit, right? You're gaining evidence. You're not just hearing stories. So can you tell me about a time when you've gone above and beyond your job description to bless your fellow employee or bless a customer? Or what does it mean to bless a customer? Well, that's actually, you'd be surprised. For us, or Christians, we're like, oh, well, I can tell you that. You'd be surprised how hard that is if you don't have a worldview that allows for that. And so we tell all of our businesses, don't be afraid of articulating your values in the interview process. You can talk about yourself all you want. You can't ask them if they go to church, but you can say, hey, I'm a Christian and I'm running this as a Christian business. It's not a prerequisite. It's not a weird thing, but just so you know what you're getting into, right? You can talk about yourself all you want. Now let's talk about our values. What does it mean to you to go above and beyond? Or what does it mean to you to bless? So you can talk about yourself and ask questions, gain evidence from them, ask them stories about how they've done that kind of thing in the past. And it is amazing if you meet a Christian and you're like, hey, I'm a conservative Christian CEO and this is how I run the business. It is a very rare Christian that won't come back with, I'm a Christian too, right? Because all of a sudden it's okay. You just said the awkward thing out loud. And if they're not, they're not, right? So there you go, little trick, yes. Yeah, no, it's a great question. And whether you're an artist or whether you're just, you know, you need to, my encouragement is you need to find someone to start the business with. And I've seen a lot of successful businesses. You know, the Bay Area company that I worked for was started by four guys. It was a guy who was a CFO, a guy who was clearly a CEO. He was a football player. He was a leader. And then a guy who was an engineer and a guy who was a sales guy. Honestly, it was the four of them. And they kind of were like the whole business. They're like, hey, let's start this business together. And they were wildly successful doing that until they took .com money and went out of business later. But and so don't be afraid to find someone who you actually trust. And man, you got to trust that person, because I've seen so many of those go totally sideways. But as long as you totally trust them and their skills complement your skills, there's nothing wrong with starting business with somebody else. But come back tomorrow.
So we're gonna end tonight. Thank you.
Yep.